Welcome to Goals Question Time, where I interview leading executives driving innovation, venturing, and strategic change.
So, hi, I'm Andrew Gall, and we're here today on Goals Question Time and our video webinar with Jonathan Hollis. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you. Really good to have you here. Been so pleased when I saw your report that you produced onto the term sheets. So we'll kick off with that in a moment with an introduction to yourself. But for those who haven't heard me before, I'm Andrew Gall. I've been involved in corporate venture capital now for over sort of 20 years in venture startups and fundraising in ventures, and that myself, you know, in the UK, Europe, the US and China. And that's my introduction. So Jonathan, if you could introduce yourself, please, and Mountainside Ventures.
Sure. So I'm Jonathan Hollis, one of the partners at Mountainside Ventures. All we do is we look to optimize the fundraising process for startups and for investors. So the day job is partnering, advising with early stage companies, typically raising late seed to Series B. We act as an extension of their team as interim CFOs. That means anything from the deck, the model, the prep, going to market and helping them negotiate term sheets. And we also work with limited partners and family offices, the investors who invest in VC funds, in helping them identify really high quality VC funds. Before I set up Mountainside Ventures 2 years ago with two other partners, I was at PwC for 10 years and set up their corporate accelerator and then their fundraising practice, and decided to leave because I got a bit tired of the politics and the stakeholder management that I'm sure you can imagine and expect at large corporates. And so we thought we'd be able to do what we do better and more agile if we run our own startup.
Excellent. Great. Now, it's a good context in that to yourself. And I think having somebody who can guide people through the experience, because you know, when you're an entrepreneur and you're starting off, you know, it's all new to you and you might only do one or two fundraisers in your whole sort of journey. So absolutely.
And it's one of the biggest pain points, you know, facing companies. And it's clear that all founders need some support, if that's leveraging, you know, their board, their existing investors, you know, their co-founders, or maybe another party that could actually professionalize the process for them.
Great. And the report that I saw you've recently done, or the study into sort of market standard sort of term sheets, I think it was excellent sort of overview. And I'd say over the years, I've helped corporates and I've helped startups and that end. And just starting from the basics of what a term sheet is, please, if you could just give a context to that, we can get into some detail then and understanding the market.
Sure. Well, it provides an overview of the key investment terms. It's essentially the blueprint that lawyers use when they're drafting the shareholder agreement. So if you're a founder, you'll have a shareholder agreement between, you know, the founders and maybe an angel investor. And when you're raising capital, you then extend that to include the investor. And the term sheet is effectively the document before that stage that summarizes the key terms. And it's roughly split into four sections. And that's the way we see it, rather than how the term sheet split. And the way to think about it is the first section is all around the deal terms, the economics, the valuation. The second section is all about conditions. So what you actually need to what you need to meet in terms of criteria, in terms of IC, in order to get the investment. The third section is all around control. So it might be the minority provisions that the investor asks you for. And then the last section is the binding terms. From a legal perspective, the most important aspect of the document, because it's the thing that actually binds you with those with that investor who's potentially investing in you.
Great. Now, I think that's an excellent overview. And, you know, in some of the previous sessions I've done, we've done seed legals with Anthony Rose, but I think that's particularly important to raise for really early stage. That might be the best route to get started in terms of writing your term sheet and doing your sort of legal agreements. But I think what we're going to get into today is probably for later stage, Series A sort of type.
Absolutely. Round. So seed legals is perfect for very early stage. Of course, it's template based. So we always recommend having a human being on top of the documentation. I think Anthony's done a fantastic job in actually industrializing this process, because it's clear that, you know, for the majority of companies, there's going to be standard terms. But when you're raising larger round, there might be nuances in the round. But of course, what's market standard really is never what you should be aiming for. You know, you should be aiming for what you believe is best for your company. And the market standard term simply there to make sure there's no surprises. So when you get a term sheet, you're like, oh, what is this? You know, founder vesting. Why am I giving up my shares for 4 years? Well, actually, this is what the rationale is, and this is what you expect as a company.
Yeah, and I think just touching there on sort of market standard, I know because I've been working this stuff globally, you know, the UK, Europe, the US and China. Your market terms, your market standard you're talking about, is that for a particular type of business and a particular type of location, or did you find differences?
Absolutely. So we looked at funds all across Europe. We had over 200 funds. We had a target of 100 and we ended up doubling that when the report was written. However, you know, it's hard to make generalizations from individual countries that you know, might not be statistically significant. What we can do is make generalizations about out of those 200. But as soon as you get a sample size of 5 or 6 within a particular location, you know, it's hard to talk about the whole population. And so the discussion that we're having is around Series A and Series B funding, typically. And it's funding that comes from venture capital funds, the EIS and VCs in the UK, and CVCs and family offices. So it's, you know, it's already within a specific group, typically institutional funding. So, you know, although we also talked to a number of seed investors, the seed investors were institutional seed investors. And so, you know, if you're raising an angel round of half a million pounds or euros, you might not be expected to give all the preference shares and have the such onerous terms. But given that the market has matured, you know, many VCs and institutional funds are now playing at the earlier stage. So I'd say that the report really is for those founders raising institutional capital in Europe. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about market standard.
Excellent. Great. And we'll be putting the links in, of course, to be able to get the report and people can look in more detail. So you've done a great overview there in terms of the number of participants in the survey, where they're sort of coming from, and also from your depth of experience now previously with PwC and now with Mountside, about your understanding what the important things to look out for. So let's dive into a few of these areas.
Yeah.
So first, share preferences. Can you explain what share preferences are? Because I think a lot of listeners might not know what share preferences are and what participating preferences and non-participating are, because this is an important factor that which comes in when the institutional investors come in.
Sure, it can get quite complicated. And in layman's terms, when you're raising investment, you might raise ordinary shares, which is saying, you know, the pretty basic rights and everyone's the same class of shares, or you could raise preference shares, and those typically have preferences attributed to those shares. It might be voting rights, or it might be certain consent, or it might be certain the way that the upon an exit shareholders get paid. Generally, investors are looking for preference shares. We found that 80% of those investors, when they're investing into companies, ask for preference shares, and 20% ordinary shares. Ordinary shares are going to be more the angels, the angel networks, and maybe co-investors. And preference shares are going to be the majority of those institutional funds. Now, in terms of preferences, so it can get quite complicated. So the first thing to think about is to separate them into two buckets. So the first bucket is whether the share is participating or not. And then the second bucket is the liquidation preference. So if we start with what is market standard, so what's market standard is a 1x non-participating preference. And what a 1x non-participating preference is that upon an exit or upon a liquidation event, if the liquidation event and if the valuation is lower than the valuation and the investor invested at, the investor gets at least their capital back. So if you invest £1 million at a 5 mil valuation and the company exits at 2, although the investor only has 20% of the company, if it exits at 2, it takes back the 1 million. And so effectively takes back 50% of the company. So it's effectively a downside protection. If the company exits a valuation that's higher, there's no change. It just converts into an ordinary share. And that seems fairly sensible for investors. You know, you're putting in money. If the company raises a lower one, you get at least your money back. And that's what's market for preferences. Now, it gets a bit more tricky if you're talking about maybe a 2x liquidation preference. So 2x liquidation preference is the investor gets at least 2x back. And so in this case, they invest in one. At five, if you exit at two, the investor gets the whole term back. And so the existing shareholders are left with nothing. And that's 2x. And of course, you can have 1x, 1.25, 1.5. And you can see from the report, if you have a look at it, there are some 1.25 and 1.5x preferences. Now, participating is something a bit different. There's no if statement. And what I mean by that is you're always getting the participating preference, i.e. a 1x participating preference is the investor always gets their money back first, and then they dip into the proceeds. So thinking about this very simple example, a one mil investment at a 5 mil pre, the company exits at 2, the investor gets the 1 back, there's 1 left, and that 1 is distributed as per the shareholding structure. So 20% to the investor, 80% to the company. So in this case, they're getting 1.2 mil out of the 2. Same thing when the exit is much greater. So what does it all mean? Well, the reason why it exists, really, it's quite an interesting reason. It's a balance of the expectation between the founder and the investor. So if I'm an investor and I believe you're worth maybe 10 million valuation and the founder believes they're worth 20, you know, there's a 2x difference, they can negotiate, or the investor might propose some structuring. And the founder might believe, you know, for your founders listening, but they might think, hey, we're gonna exit for half a billion. I don't care about giving you an extra 2 million if I exit half a billion, because even if it's participating, if I'm exiting at 500 million, I've got to pay 2 million before getting my proceeds. It's pretty trivial. But if I'm exiting at 20 mil and I'm paying 2 before everyone else gets the capital, then it gets quite material. And so the reason why they're there is that they're a tool that investors and founders can use to try and bridge that gap between valuation expectation. But the key thing founders should know is that the market standard is this 1x non-participating preference.
Which, as you said, seems a reasonable sort of thing when somebody's putting in somebody else's money, so that the limited partners who put the money into the fund, those partners want to make sure at least they're going to get their money back. Now, of course, they're wanting the multiples of exit, but they want to protect their sort of downside and a one time.
Exactly. And you can imagine that in the UK or across Europe, you know, many funds are looking for the big exits and therefore care less about their downside, but many funds care about the downside protection. And so the ones that are happy with 3, 4, 5x returns, you know, they'll want to keep their 1 million in this example they've invested. And so as well as it being a bargaining tool for founders and a negotiation tool for founders and investors, it also depends on the type of investor you are.
Yeah. Okay. Now that's great. The next item that I wanted to highlight from your sort of term sheet is board seats.
Yeah.
You know, you're a startup, there's yourself, your founder, maybe another angel and that there. What's the sort of typical market sort of standard now when you get to the Series A?
So what's typical is that the majority of investors who want to lead require a board seat. Those who typically only co-invest don't, unless they're investing a significant pool of capital. But generally, you know, a Series A, Series B, the last person in wants to have a seat at the table. And so the analysis and I guess the advice that we have is, if you know you're bringing on someone, an investor, you want to try and make sure as a founder that the board is founder controlled, i.e. If you're a team of 3 board members, one of them being an investor, you've got 2 co-founders and the 2 can push order resolutions forward. If you've got co-investors, i.e. there might be 2 board seats who put in the same amount. If there's 2 investors, then you know the best thing to do is to have 5 board members, because then you have maybe 2 founders, 2 investors, and a chairman that is appointed by the founders. And so it's important generally when you're raising capital, especially at the early stage, that the board isn't controlled by investors. They might have their veto rights, but the company isn't controlled by those investors.
Right. And so, you know, the investors, you want them participating in those types of things because they can often bring you leads, new investments, advice.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, founder vesting. I've been through a number of startups, and you know, the initial part about, you know, what equity is mine, what equity is the other founder, and then you might split up. And I've been an investor in some businesses where it's been sort of acrimonious and sort of stuff like that. So explain the general concept of founder vesting, but then also when investment comes in from an institutional about how they can change those things.
Sure. So the general concept, again, to the investor makes sense because it's a way of A, incentivizing founders to stick around, and B, allowing the possibility of hiring a new CEO or a new founding team to the team if someone leaves, because you need, if you're going to parachute a CEO in, he or she will need to have some shares. And, you know, if the founder leaves and the founder has 80% of the shares, how on earth are you going to do that? You know, the investment, the investor put in maybe a million, maybe five, maybe 10, it needs to have some mechanism to actually keep the business going. On the other hand, of course, you know, if a small team, if it's a solo founder, the founder is the business. And so you can argue, why on earth would you have these founder vesting? Because the founder goes, the business probably goes. But, you know, we'll put that to one side a minute and explore what we found, which was that 98% of investors ask for some form of founder vesting, which might surprise some founders. But actually, if you end up a term sheet and you end up with an investor asking for this type of scenario, which in very simple terms, you know, you've built your business, you've worked hard, and you ask for investment from an institutional investor, they'll probably say, we would like your shares or a proportion of your shares to be taken away effectively over a period of time. And what we found was that the most common request was for a 4-year monthly vesting period with a 12-month cliff, which means for the first 12 months, you didn't have any shares. Day one of year two, you have your 12 months of shares, and then it's monthly for the next 3 years. And that was the most common scenario. We also found that founder vesting gave rise to the biggest difference in variance, i.e., you know, there isn't really a market because so many different options still exist. You know, there might be monthly, it might be quarterly, it might be yearly, it might be 3 years, it might be 2 years, it might be 4 years, it might have a monthly cliff. Then you've got the next analysis, which is it proportion of shares? Is it all your shares? Is it 20%? Is it 30%? And the negotiation tool in terms of our recommendation to those listing is, yes, accept that the market is, there is some founder vesting. Of course, push for nothing. If the investor won't accept no founder vesting, we recommend you to negotiate and ask for a percentage of your shares. So maybe you have 2/3 of your shares banked. You know, we say banked, and the founder might think, well, of course it's banked, I've just built the company. But let's work with the definitions. You know, 2/3 is vested, and then 1/3 is vested over 4 years. And that might make it a bit more palatable to many of those investors. And this is an area that we spend quite a bit of time on, because, of course, we can support the company in explaining how that works, and also maybe play bad cop with the investor. Because if a founder says, you know, I don't want to have any shares vesting, my answer as an investor would be, well, you're not committed to the business. Whereas maybe if an advisor or maybe a board member has that conversation, you can be a bit more bullish. And you know, it's a psychological aspect. It's not that they don't want to continue the business. It's a, you know, they've built this baby and you're taking their shares away from them. And so you can be a bit more, you can play this this role a bit better.
Great. So that's the founder part. But one I often see is connected to this is share options. So yeah. you want a pool to give to new employees and new executives and that coming in. What were your findings in the share option pool and when and so, how they're done?
It's 5-15%. 5-10 was the most common. 10-15 was the next common. Interestingly, we didn't see a significant variance, or at least not a statistically significant variance, across fund stages. So, you know, you would expect, you know, probably a bit more share options at seed and A, and probably a bit less at B and C. And actually, it was fairly common across the board, you know, 5-15 with a preference of 5-10 minimum. And I think the data shows that, you know, the more you incentivize employees, the better, the more likely the better the business is to succeed.
Good. Well, one that's close to my heart at the moment, because fundraising for a business called Circuloil, which is in the sustainable and circular economy sort of side of disrupting and changing the lubricant oil sort of type space. So sustainability and ESG type aspects are particularly important in that for us. What did you find within the term sheet or within the negotiations that sustainability sort of targets were in there? How is that being thought of now in marketplace?
Yeah. So we didn't touch too much about this in the report, but we do have the data, and the data was that a third of all investors request this in their term sheets. We are likely going to do a bit deeper dive next year or the year after when we do this survey and this report again. But at the moment, that was the initial findings. Is a third of investors, and from our experience, we know that they don't request ESG and sustainability clause. It's a soft commitment. So it's, we would like you to. And you know, I'm sure that will change in the future. And I think a third, given that I suspected 5-6 years ago that number was significantly lower, is a good is positive steps. And I suspect that will only increase as the time goes. But that's what we found on sustainability within ESG. We didn't do a dive into E, S, or G. It was the ESG clause in general. So I guess it's, you know, good news for that starter that you talked about, because it shows that, you know, investors, even if they're not impact funds, have an ESG focus.
Yeah. Okay. So I've got one other area I want to focus down onto, but you know, the report and the thing covers a lot of areas. So I'll come back to you for you to pick out your favourites in that in a moment. But the one other one I thought was a useful metric was the time to doing a deal. How long does it take from getting the first contact through to having the money in the bank? What were you finding in terms of that?
So very simply, 8 to 12 weeks. Although not in our experience, it's you know, a lot longer than that. I guess from the perspective of the investor, it might be 8 to 12 weeks. I think the reason why we asked that question and published it is if you go on VC Twitter, you know, it feels like some deals are done in 24 hours, and you know, in a week. Which I think maybe for 1% of the 1%, but for the majority of companies, you know, the data is quite clear from the investor perspective. It's an 8 to 12 week process, and of course the data is a bit skewed because a company might be fundraising for a lot longer than that, but met their ideal investor, and then the ideal investors of 8 to 12 weeks. So I would say you probably can probably double that standard period because it's the, you know from the perspective of the capital. If you're talking about the perspective of the person looking for capital, you know, they might spend a couple of months before meeting this investor who then saw the company and invested within a 12-week process.
Yeah.
So I'd say that in our experience, it's a 6 to 9 month process, including the prep. So it might be 2 to 3 months of prep. And from an investor perspective, it's this 3 month side. And from a founder perspective, you probably need to double that.
Yeah. No, good perspective there. I think, yeah, from depending which perspective you come from, that time
and exactly.
That can be quite different, because you know it's when you found the ideal partner, then it can be quite long. It can
exactly.
Be quite quick, but it's
and then like, the ideal partner's like that, exactly. And the ideal partner's like, oh, it only took a month. Well, yeah, I've been looking for 6.
Yeah. And I've kissed lots of other frogs and spoke with lots of other people who've been probably very helpful in pointing them in other directions and all that.
Exactly.
So out of doing this whole process, yourself and your colleagues in Mountside Ventures, what was it, any key things that stood out for you from going through this and producing this report now?
I think overall, I mean, we do this day in, day out, so none of the results for us were surprising. But I think for the founder seeing the report for the first time, I suspect the three key areas, the first one being, you know, okay, fine, founder vesting is standard and I need to understand the rationale and negotiate, you know, maybe my good leave or bad leave provisions correctly, because we didn't do much on that. And we've seen lots of different variants within good leave or bad leave. I think the second one is, oh, okay, great. If it doesn't take me a week to close, I'm not in the minority. The majority of companies take, 3, 4, 5 months to close. And I think the last one, which we haven't touched upon, is the fees. The fees that VCs charge, and this is always a contentious debate, which straight it shouldn't be, because you know it's important for founders to always look at the net investment into their cash, not the gross amount, which might be include deal fees or legal fees or management fees. And what we found is that the majority of funds ask between 1 to 2%. Of the amount, and it depends massively on the type of investor. So, you know, I mentioned in the report, angel networks, crowdfunders. You know, we didn't report crowdfunders, but crowdfunders are charging between 6 to 8% of capital and some form of fee on top of that for setup. Same thing with angel networks; it might be 5 to 10% of capital with some setup fees. But that's the key, I guess, the key area of understanding is founders to understand which type of fund they're speaking to. You know, is it a VC with limited partners who are investing into the fund, and therefore the VC takes the majority of their fees from those investors? Or maybe an EIS or VC fund in the UK, a tax efficient fund, that instead of taking the majority of their fees from their own investors, they take the majority of their fees from companies. And so the net impact is what to look at. So I think that's an important conclusion to understand, because there's always complaints from startups saying, oh, you know, the investors should be investing, not taking cash away. But of course, it fails to grasp that the person that is doing the investing needs to be paid, needs to be, you know, has rent and food to pay. And they can't all live on the promise that in 10 years' time, that particular investment will turn into a unicorn. They've got to, you know, they've got to have some salary. And that salary either gets paid out of the investment that goes into startups, or it gets paid out of the investment coming down the food chain. And so an understanding of how the fund is made up, is it goes a long way to empathizing and understanding the key terms in the term sheet.
Excellent. Oh, Jonathan, that's been fantastic. Great to get an understanding of where you fit within the ecosystem. Great to get an understanding of what's sort of the general sort of terms and the term sheet. And also, I think it's really good to get that framework in people's minds of some of the key terms and that within the term sheet document when you're doing venture funding. So
absolutely,
really appreciate the time and for sharing it.
And for those who want to get in touch, I'm at jonathan@mountainsideventures.com. Always happy to chat. And you can find lots of resources on our website.
Yeah. I've been dipping into that as well. So yeah, we'll put the links to that material, and I appreciate you spending the time and sharing it with the ecosystem.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Please do subscribe for future podcasts. Thank you.